Hey, this is Derek. And you're listening to Skepticality, the official audio program of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, March 26th,
2013.
Welcome back to an episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with skeptics and critical thinkers from all walks of life for the promotion of an advancement of science. It was great to see some of you out for the big live joint podcast recording here in Atlanta. It involved John Snyder of American Freethought, Blake Smith of our sister podcast, Monster Talk, and myself. Keep an eye out on the Skepticality website, Facebook, or Twitter feeds for the link to that recording. The audio will be made available on the Atlanta Skeptics feed, which is run by Mark Disler of Abrupt Media. Since Tim Farley is currently off playing with giant tortoises down in Galapagos, I get to bring you the return of my friend, Bob Carroll, followed by some of our regular skeptical friends.
This is Bob Carroll. Welcome to another episode of Unnatural Virtue. Today's topic is magical thinking. Children are told stories about flying reindeer, talking frogs, and wishes that come true by blowing on a small fire atop a cake. Adults knock on wood, make the sign of the cross, wear twisted ropes around their necks and rubber bracelets for power and luck. All of us at one time or another have seen connections between things that aren't causally related, and felt those connections were real and significant. Magical thinking is natural. We're hardwired to see connections. This makes it possible for us to see causal connections, the most important kind of connection there is for survival as a species. It also makes it probable that we're going to see causal connections where there aren't any. Overcoming the tendency to see causal connections where there aren't any is one of the benefits of applying logic to the testing of causal hypotheses. When the natural bias we all have to make causal connections between things that happen closely in space and time is combined with false beliefs, the result is often zealous bigotry, whose fervor is matched only by the ignorance on which it is based. The combination of magical thinking and ignorance can lead one to reject the results of well-designed scientific tests in favor of poorly thought-out conclusions based on personal experience. Many people, for example, are convinced that aspartame is a dangerous neurotoxin that causes brain damage and other serious harm to humans. They know this because they've read it in many authoritative-looking places on the Internet. They know this because their nervous disorders and muddled thinking went away after they stopped using aspartame. Their belief is not affected by the science. In fact, they have seen on the Internet many references to scientific studies that support their belief that aspartame is a danger to human health. There are so many people who believe in the dangers of aspartame that David Hatton of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has posted a letter noting that numerous studies have been done on aspartame and that the FDA continues to consider aspartame safe for human consumption. In addition, Hatton addressed some of the main myths about aspartame flourishing on the Internet. Here's a summary of Hatton's response to the fearmongers. The scientific evidence does not support the claim that aspartame is linked to an increased number of brain tumors in humans. The scientific evidence does not support the claim that aspartame is linked to birth defects or adverse effects on reproduction in either laboratory animals or humans. The scientific evidence does not support the claim that aspartame is linked to seizures in laboratory animals or humans. The scientific evidence does not support the claim that aspartame is linked to multiple sclerosis or systemic lupus. The scientific evidence does support the claim that people with PKU, a rare metabolic disease, should not use aspartame because their livers do not produce the enzyme needed to break down one of the amino acids resulting from the ingestion of aspartame. Phenylalanine is an essential amino acid, and those born with the genetic disorder PKU who are fed high-protein diets will develop mental retardation. I suppose it is true that a newborn fed a diet of nothing but very large amounts of aspartame would experience serious brain damage. If you do not have PKU, however, you will metabolize phenylalanine just fine, and it will not adversely affect your brain. Scientific evidence also supports the claim that aspartame ingestion results in the production of methanol, which is metabolized to formaldehyde and formate. Scientific evidence supports the claim that methanol is toxic when humans consume it in large quantities. However, in order to accumulate a significant amount of formate, a human must consume 200 to 500 milligrams of methanol per kilogram of body weight. Depending on your weight, that would translate into something like 600 to 1700 cups of sweetened coffee or cans of diet soda. And since methanol is metabolized and does not accumulate in the body, you'd have to ingest this large amount of aspartame all at once. The amount of aspartame any human is likely to consume is unlikely to result in an excessive amount of methanol. Methanol is found naturally in many foods such as fruits and vegetables and their juices, and it is found in much greater quantity in these healthy foods than in a packet or two of aspartame. A serving of tomato juice, for example, provides about 6 times more methanol than the same amount of an aspartame sweetened beverage. The greatest source of excessive methanol intake is due to alcohol abuse. If I wanted to avoid brain damage, I think I'd avoid overindulgence of liquor, wine, and beer, and not worry too much about aspartame. To those who think magical thinking is superior to science, I'd recommend taking a week or two off of the internet to study why scientists do randomized controlled studies and why dose is important when considering the adverse effects of a neurotoxin or carcinogen. Well, that's it for this episode of Unnatural Virtue. To find out more about the topics mentioned here, see the show notes and my website, The Skeptic's Dictionary. In the meantime, please commit some unnatural acts in public, and don't forget, skepticism, though unnatural, is a virtue.
I'm Heather Henderson, and this is the News in Religion. A small United Methodist church in North Carolina said it will not host weddings for heterosexual couples until the rest of the Protestant denomination ends its ban on same-sex marriage, an unusual step in the traditionally conservative U.S. South. The move comes as the Supreme Court is set to take up a pair of significant gay right cases next week, including a review of a California law that defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. I do not see it as an act of exclusion for straight couples, but an invitation for all people to be in solidarity with those who are excluded, Senior Pastor Kelly Carpenter wrote in a letter to members. The church leaders also asked their pastors to refrain from signing marriage licenses issued by North Carolina or any other state that does not allow same-sex couples to marry. Alcoholics Anonymous's focus on spirituality has been a cause of internal debate. Has AA become too God-focused and rigid, or have groups watered down beliefs and methods so much that they're now ineffective? With more than 100,000 local meetings and an estimated 2 million members worldwide, AA is grappling with how much diversity it can handle. Over the past 2 years, umbrella organizations in Indianapolis and Toronto have delisted groups that replaced AA's 12 steps to recovery with secular alternatives. Some argue that AA seldom offers the tough love that alcoholics need. Too many meetings ignore the 12 steps posted on their walls, said Charles Peabody, a 35-year-old former alcoholic and drug addict. Roger C., a Toronto agnostic, brings a different concern. Those who insist on doing the original 12 steps, he says, are apt to alienate non-believers who might never get the help they need. Lee Ann Kaskoutis, senior scientist at the Public Health Institute's Alcohol Research Group in Emeryville, California, says, because there is this ethic of take what you need and leave the rest, it puts the attendee in a position of being able to form a program that is palatable to them. AA is doing just fine. Pope Francis is blowing up the Twitterverse. With many of his 9 multilingual accounts actively pulling in thousands of new followers every day, the Pope has already become a force to be reckoned with in the land of social media. Though papal predecessor Pope Benedict caused quite a stir when he first entered the Twitter sphere in December, insiders say Pope Francis's presence on social media will likely be even more significant in the coming months and years. As of Tuesday, Pope Francis, who incidentally follows only himself on Twitter and has been identified as a social media newbie, boasts a total of about 3.98 million Twitter followers. Ultimately, experts say that social media will be an important tool that Pope Francis and the Catholic Church could use to reach believers and non-believers alike, especially as Twitter and other social media platforms gain in popularity and social importance. I'm Heather Henderson, and this was the News in Religion. Visit my other podcasts at ardentatheist.com and skepticallyyours.net. Special thanks to my audio engineer, Emery Emery. The News in Religion was brought to you through the Scientific Method.
Hello, this is Susan Gerbic speaking to you about guerrilla skepticism on Wikipedia and how to make a difference to the skeptical cause with real activism. One method I stress to the editing team is to work backwards. Start with a citation that is notable or from a notable source. For simplicity, when I say notable, I mean that the source also has a Wikipedia page. In the example I'm about to give, I found this in my email, sent from the JREF. It is a press release to Priceline.com calling out their new spokesperson, Teresa Caputo, better known as the Long Island Medium. I'll admit it, when I find an interesting story like this, I share it on my social networks. In total, I would reach potential views of about 2,000 people, and only while the link remained in my feed. Probably only a few hundred people would see the announcement, and even less would have read it. Everyone I would have reached would be already in the skeptical choir, in other words, very low impact. Working backwards, I'm able to take that same JREF press release and edit the following onto the Wikipedia Priceline.com page, which now reads, JWEF President DJ Grothy released a press release calling out Priceline.com stating, quote, "It is difficult to watch the show and not feel heartbroken for those who are desperate to hear from the departed, and even more so if they are being manipulated by a charlatan," unquote. Grothy urges Priceline.com to invite your new representative to take the James Randi $1 million challenge and prove her credentials. So I know you're asking yourself, are people really reading the Priceline Wikipedia page? How many people do you think access that page each month? Well, in August 2012, the Priceline Wikipedia page received 16,361 views. That's quite a bit more than if I'd simply shared the press release on my Facebook or Twitter feed. In November 2012, Priceline hit 18,537 views. Over 200,000 people each year visit the Priceline Wikipedia page. I would also like to remind you that those are viewers outside of our skeptical community. I'm a recycling kind of person, so why waste a wonderful press release on just one page? So after I had edited the Priceline page, I ventured over to the Long Island Medium Wikipedia page and left the same edit. Now this time the viewers are definitely not in the skeptical inquirer. Most are fans of Teresa Caputo. So how many views? In November 2012, 79,230 people viewed her Wikipedia page. As she rises in popularity, so does her Wikipedia hits. At this rate, she could easily hit 1 million views in 2013. Outreach we are unlikely to reach, even with the most awesome anti-Teresa video or blog. Someone on the side of critical thinking and sanity needs to be waiting for those readers, and that would be us, the team of guerrilla skeptics on Wikipedia. Interested in joining our team? We badly need your help, and we do train. Visit our blog at guerrillaskepticism on wikipedia.blogspot.com or email me directly at susangerbic@yahoo.com. I promise you won't have to watch one episode of Teresa Caputo cold read her way through an audience, unless you're into that sort of thing. Thank you.
Siebert of SkepticalHumanities.com and VirtualSkeptics.com. Consider the following scenario. A young woman is asleep in bed. She wakes up but cannot move. She becomes aware of a malevolent presence in the room. The being presses on her chest, making breathing difficult. What's happening? Has the young woman been attacked by a demon or vampire? Is she being abducted by aliens? Through my keen psychic powers, I can hear many skeptics declaring, "Sleep paralysis!" A few add the mysterious words, "hypnagogic" or "hypnopompic" hallucination. Certainly sleep paralysis, during which the brain is conscious or on the verge of wakefulness, but the body remains locked down, may be behind many apparent paranormal experiences, especially when accompanied by the hallucinations that may occur as one is falling asleep or waking up. Sleep paralysis is common. Many people will experience it at least once in their lives. Some experience it commonly. The experience can be terrifying, and the hallucinations can seem very real. Many people swear they are awake because, in fact, they are. Mostly. The experience of sleep paralysis varies over time and according to cultural expectation. In medieval and Renaissance Europe, people experienced demon attacks. In 18th century Serbia, sometimes vampires visited their victims at night. Since the second half of the 20th century, the assailants have often been aliens. Are we, as skeptics, justified in dismissing all these stories as sleep paralysis? Well, sort of, but these stories are so prevalent that they've moved from the world of physical phenomenon to the realm of folktale motif. A folk motif is a recurring and recognizable element in traditional narratives. For instance, a cruel stepmother is a motif that appears again and again in folktales. Another example is the supernatural being who helps the hero or heroine perform chores. In the 1930s, Stith Thompson published his monumental 6-volume motif index of folk literature. Entry F471 deals with dream demons. F471.1 is the nightmare, which, quote, presses person in dream, unquote. There follows a long list of sources. The Wikipedia entry on sleep paralysis also includes a lengthy list of related folklore. According to Carl Lindahl, John McNamara, and John Lindau in medieval folklore, the assaults of the Mara, nightmare or night hag, quote, were always connected with a feeling of anxiety and suffocation. The Mara was believed to oppress and weigh her victim down when tormenting and riding it. Jan Perkowski, professor of Slavic languages, has published extensively in Slavic folklore. He has collected numerous tales of the Kashubian Mara, or succuba. He describes it as a night spirit which suffocates its sleeping victims. Demons, night hags, witches, ghosts, vampires, and now aliens. All have attacked and suffocated victims in the night. Were all the victims suffering from sleep paralysis? Probably not. While sleep paralysis no doubt serves as the origin for this motif, the motif has grown beyond the physical phenomenon. It's become part of the story of beings that attack at night, and it's been part of the story for a very long time. I'm not saying that stories about beings who sit on sleepers' chests or who suffocate them are made-up lies, but rather that the experience has become an expected element. We know that cultural expectations shape perception and memory. For instance, it's been suggested that some of the elements of Betty and Barney Hill's alien abduction accounts were based subconsciously on TV shows and movies. Certainly, the Hill story has influenced other accounts of alien abduction. Even the fact that experiences that would once have been perceived as demon attacks are now interpreted as alien visitations suggests just how much cultural expectation influences perception. To return to the young woman being attacked in her bed, perhaps she is experiencing sleep paralysis, or perhaps her story exemplifies the power of folk tales. For more on sleep paralysis and the suffocating night spirit, visit skepticalhumanities.com.
Hello and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality, where you go to that thrift shop down the road, buy some granddad's clothes, get home, check the tag, and find out they really did belong to your granddad. And you look incredible.
I'm Wendy Hughes.
And I'm Jarrett Kaufman.
And we're here to tell you stories contributed by readers and listeners who were amazed and surprised by coincidences, just like this.
Everyone has lost their keys, but how many times did you have your keys, yet no matter how much you tried, you couldn't get any of them to fit in the lock?
I've done that. I have a lot of keys and a lot of locked doors.
Well, this story takes that concept and twists it just a little bit. Contributor John Muser brings us a key question, which you can find on the site today or through our link in the show notes. John begins. I grew up on a farm in a rural community in Indiana. The high school I went to had been consolidated from several small town schools in the area, so almost all students were bused in, being picked up from houses which were widespread. Even though our house was only about 15 miles from the school, it took about an hour for the daily commute. Pretty much all students get their driver's license as soon as possible so that they don't have to go through this lengthy process every day. My younger brother is mentally handicapped, so was unable to get his license at the same time all of his friends did, but my parents didn't want him to miss out, so they allowed him to drive an off-road utility vehicle, best described as a large golf cart, to school every day. The brand was a Cushman, but I have no idea the model. He probably had a longer commute than if he rode the bus, but my brother loved the independence. He also had problems with the combination padlocks on the lockers, so the school allowed him to use a padlock which takes a key. This is a very rural area where no one locks their doors, so the only two keys that my brother ever carried were the key to his locker and the key to his Cushman. He was unlocking his locker one morning and realized that he had accidentally gotten the two keys mixed up, but was surprised to find that both keys were completely interchangeable. His Cushman key could unlock his locker, and vice versa. What are the odds that the only two locks in the world that my brother needed to use took the exact same key?
My usual problem is that I try the wrong key the first time, because a lot of them are the same shape and size. But it seems like a padlock key and an ignition key for an off-road vehicle would look very different.
Well, interestingly enough, and as I feared, our resident statistics expert Barbara Drescher also didn't have an answer for us, although she did say she's had a similar experience. But this one's required knowledge is just a little too specialized for her.
I remember one IIG meeting when our training czar, IIG Steering Committee member Spencer Marks, taught us all how to pick a lock. Or maybe I should say he was demonstrating how a police officer uses special tools to gain access to a crime scene.
Wink, wink. And it's that sort of skill set that might help us out here. So, for the first time in the Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality history, we're reaching out to you, the listeners, for some assistance. We get that there are only so many combinations of shapes, sizes, and notches in a key, and occasionally they're going to line up. But what we want to know is if any locksmiths or Cushman fanatics might have a real answer for us. Did these cart ignitions buy their parts off the same manufacturer? Were they notoriously insecure? Interchangeable? There's got to be more to this story, and we'd love to hear about it.
So please visit our website and comment on this story to let us know if you've got useful information for us to flesh out this story. If we get some good leads, we'll share the results in a future episode. I'm out of my depth here, and when I hear about locks, I automatically go to the kind that goes well on bagels with some schmear.
Is it always about food with you, Wendy?
Statistics make me hungry.
Thanks for listening to The Odds Must Be Crazy. Please visit theoddsmustbecrazy.com to add your voice to the discussions for any of our stories. We love know-it-alls who correct our facts. Seriously.
Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, circle us on Google+, and validate us in life. Hit the Submit a Story link on our site to share your own crazy stories, or tweet the short ones with the hashtag TOMBC.
The Odds Must Be Crazy is a project in collaboration with the Independent Investigations Group in Los Angeles, California. Visit them at iigwest.org.
Barbara Drescher is a contributing editor to our blog and can also be found at icbseverywhere.com.
Our theme music comes to us courtesy of Mr. Deity himself, Brian Keith Dalton. You can find him at mrdeity.com.
Good joke about being locked out or keyed up or 1, 2, 3 ignition.
Did you just read the script's improvisation description out loud?
Hey, you're the actor. I just read the script. If you want improvisation, write your own.
A few months back, I got to meet a local Atlanta skeptic, Lauren Collins. He let me know a bit about some of the cool, skeptically related things he'd been up to here in the local area, and how through his work and research, it led him down the path to writing a book. Since the book is a great resource for any skeptic, I had to have him on the show. So today I am here with Lauren Collins. Is that you?
That's me, Derek. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem. So I have you on because you have a new book that's come out recently. But before that, let's give people an idea who you are. You are a lawyer?
That's right.
What kind of lawyer are you?
Practice personal injury. Been doing it just a hair over 7 years.
You ever watch Breaking Bad?
Oh, I love Breaking Bad.
So are you Saul?
I am not Saul Goodman, unfortunately. I have better hair than Saul Goodman.
Oh, okay, there you go. Now, you've actually been published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is a local Atlanta newspaper.
That's right.
So you're based in Atlanta, kind of like I am.
Yes, sir.
And then in the newspaper, the things you put in were on misinformation and critical thinking. In Atlanta, how'd that go over?
Went over pretty well, actually. Didn't get an awful lot of feedback from it, but the general reception I got was positive. Sad to say, the last time I tried to send something to the AJC on critical thinking that was just about 2 months ago, they rejected it. I sent them a piece in response to Representative Paul Brown here from Georgia, who'd made some comments about how evolution and certain sciences were lies from the pit of hell.
Yeah, that was fun. I remember that.
Yeah, and I dragged him over the coals for being an anti-science legislator sitting on the science committee. Yeah. And the response I got from the AJC was, you know, thanks for your submission, but we like to stick to local issues things that are newsworthy or something. They wanted to stay out of politics. That's what it was. And my response to that was, this is less political than the other things I wrote. It involves a politician, but it's a science-based article.
Yeah.
And he's a Georgia representative. I'm not sure how this doesn't apply, but so be it.
I guess they like lies from the pit of hell. So you, on that same vein, you have a website called Birth of a Notion.
Yes. That was a website I set up at one point. It was actually a working title of my book at one point. But it was a spinoff of my site, Barocraful, which is a blog I've run for a few years that dealt with rumors and hoaxes and lies and stuff regarding President Obama, and specifically the birther conspiracy theories that surround him and his past.
Well, there was a on that other, the Barocraful.
Yes.
You had this really fun, almost like fake conversation on there. I found really funny that I think it's still on there, out there. So I'm going to link to it.
Okay.
About, you know, the why doesn't he just give us the birth certificate? Well, he already did. But on 91, I want a longer one. So it was just funny because what the conversation might be fake, but all the answers were pretty true from everything I've seen from people, even on news interviews.
Oh, thanks. What makes me kind of proud of that is I posted that on Inauguration Day back in 2009. I wrote that up, put it online two months after the election, kind of as a prediction of how things would go. And doggone it, if it isn't exactly how it's played out for the last 4 years.
No, it's still going.
Yes, and still going.
Donald Trump is still banging that drum.
Donald Trump is. I just saw an interview with someone talking to Sheriff Joe Arpaio out of Arizona.
Well, of him, okay.
And he's still pushing his claim that he and his little citizens posse, you know, have found evidence of fraud. And yeah.
Okay. Well, sheriffs are usually voted on too. I guess his constituents really like that type of crazy.
They reelected him just last month, sadly. Yeah.
So sometimes you can't account for taste.
No.
You said something about the fact that you ran for politics once. That was in 2008?
I did a write-in campaign for my House district, congressional House district. I think I did one in 2006 and one in 2008. My district... just a metro Atlanta district, but it's the one that used to be held by Cynthia McKinney.
Oh, okay.
Who listeners may know by reputation. But 2008 was pretty uneventful. 2006, though, even just being a write-in, when they had little local debates and candidate forums, I got in touch with the places that were holding those, and they let me participate. And so I was up there on stage with the Republican and the Democratic candidate. I was running under the Bull Moose banner myself.
you revived that one.
I did. It seemed much more catchy than the Whigs.
Well, true. Although that would have been the original.
That would have been the original. But they don't have a mascot, you see.
Oh, true. Well, you could. You could use who was it? Was it Franklin?
Use a turkey?
Oh, that's right. You're right. I was wrong.
So an elephant and a donkey. Nothing has sort of imposing American stature like a bull moose.
True. The sad part is, if you had won, I can imagine that somebody from Alaska would have tried to use that one too.
Yeah, true.
And then you also had the facts that Kevin Trudeau doesn't want you to know about, which is kind
of fun. Yeah, that was something I put together back in college, and still have hanging around. That was one of my first ventures into sort of skepticism and trying to expose someone. Obviously, I was not the first to jump on Kevin Trudeau, but I was doing my best to sort of collect a lot of the material that had exposed and debunked him and put it in one place, generally in the hopes that someone who would Google his name, that would show up high enough in the rankings that they would realize what a disreputable purveyor of falsehoods he is.
I don't think there can be enough of that type of thing, especially in his case.
Yeah.
Then that leads us to the... You decided to make the title of your book, Bullspotting.
Yes. Bullspotting, Finding Facts in the Age of Misinformation.
And I like, almost right off the bat, you have a quote by Mark Twain, "A lie will go around the world while truth is pulling its boots on."
Mm-hmm.
So what led you to creating the book?
What led me to creating the book was, it kind of goes back to that blog I mentioned earlier, the Barackrafal birther related thing. I'd gotten into debunking that primarily out of an interest of just sort of killing it dead. I'm actually not an Obama supporter, really, but as a conservative libertarian, really, that kind of stuff aggravated me terribly, and I kind of wanted to kill that kind of nonsense. Because I basically thought it made other people of my political persuasion look bad, which it does and still does. And so I started the blog, debunk stuff. And at some point I thought I could collect some of that material into a book. And when I started shopping around that as a book, one of the responses I got after I had thought of using the material and not just pitching it as just sort of a history of the movement or just sort of a debunking book, I thought I could use that material, being sort of contemporary and high profile to an extent, to sort of educate people on skepticism and critical thinking, because it had a lot of those aspects to it, even pseudoscience, amazingly enough. And when I got a response back from my publisher, their suggestion was, why not do it, but, don't restrict yourself to just examples from this one area, do the same sort of skeptical field guide, but use examples from all across the spectrum, from across history and in different arenas. And so that's what I did. I think it worked out a lot better that way. It's a lot less niche.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because the chapters themselves are almost like a bullet list of some of the major topic areas that most skeptics think about. You have like a whole chapter just for denialism, conspiracy theories, rumors, quotations, hoaxes, pseudoscience. It goes on like that.
Yeah.
And even at the bottom was what's the harm is one of the chapters. So I'm sure Tim Foley would like that.
I think I credit him in the back, actually.
Yeah, I know. Which I thought was funny. Yeah. So it was, what was the, what was your favorite area that you didn't originally think of that you, because like you mentioned that you originally were focused on your original website, what area did you get into that you weren't involved with before that made you really stand up and take notice?
One thing that I ended up writing an awful lot about was a subject I was interested in previously, but you know, hadn't written much of anything about in the past, and that was on sort of the history of creationism. I spent the pseudoscience chapter ended up being the longest one in the book because I ended up basically going from flat Earth up through geocentrism and then on into young Earth theories. I frankly think that's probably the best researched part of the book. I ended up putting so much effort into it. But yeah, that was something I didn't set out to write about specifically, but it's something I ended up finding myself highly interested in researching and writing about.
What I liked is that the one area that even skeptics often don't think about is actually in this book, and it makes sense that you wrote it, is the pseudo-law chapter.
Yeah, as I think I dropped a mention in there, pseudo-law doesn't even have a Wikipedia page.
I know.
I think it has one on the Reason Wiki or something like that. But yeah, it surprised me too when I went looking for it that there hasn't been an awful lot written on pseudo-law. But it certainly has its effects, and it affects people in society and in sort of subtle, fringy ways. Whether it be people just wasting the time of the courts with sovereign citizen nonsense, occasionally it runs into normal people. I believe I heard the story one time on, I want to say it was on This American Life, of someone who found themselves being harassed, with some paper terrorism from someone who claimed that if they just filed the right papers with the court, they could take their property. And the court system sometimes, you know, obviously they're wrong, but the court system's not built to handle people who are just, you know, working that far outside the normal system. And when they have to process that through normal procedures, people get hurt simply by the lag time.
Yeah, and then it comes to things like people who believe that they can dodge taxes because they mistakenly believe that that's illegal.
Yeah, and that's probably the most famous and widespread example of pseudo-law. That's the kind that, you know, if it wasn't for some court decisions to the contrary, you'd probably see it being advertised on TV.
Yeah.
That you know, how you can secretly get away with, you know, not paying taxes. You know, as I talk about, it's what you saw snare Wesley Snipes a few years ago. And he ended up, you know, getting convicted. I think he actually managed to escape some of the worst convictions, basically on the grounds of he didn't know what he was doing. But yeah, the people who spread the tax avoidance, you know, the ones who are doing that are some of the worst purveyors of misinformation because, like Kevin Trudeau, they're out there doing it with a profit motive. You know, they're trying to pull the wool over people's eyes in the hopes of making money off of them.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember back when I was younger, I remember seeing people on TV making those claims, and I don't see that anymore. You mentioned that they actually fixed that with the law?
I think they have. I think there have been either some court decisions or some regulations that were passed probably in the 80s where basically it after enough decisions where it was determined that there is no legal basis for this. I certainly know for a fact that simply advertising it even as a product, you know, regardless of whether it's on television or not, but it runs afoul of some federal laws where if you try to advertise that that you're selling a product that says that people don't legally have to pay taxes, and that's what's gotten some of these people in trouble because they try to sell these sort of tax avoidance packages to people. And what usually ends up happening is they try to rebrand them some way. They kind of try to come up with creative ways to title them other ways to try to sell the concept without actually saying the words. It's the same kind of the same thing, frankly. Again, you saw with Trudeau after he got banned from the airwaves for, you know, saying as many lies as he did. He turned to books, and the FCC couldn't do anything about him trying to publish books because he had a free speech right to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds very much the same.
Yeah. But what Trudeau gets around, the way he's able to get around it is he's lying, but he's not making any legal claims. And the folks who are trying to advertise that, you know, you don't have an obligation to pay, you know, to report or to pay taxes are basically, in a sense, practicing law without a license.
There's many times I believe that there's a lot of facets of society where they touch on things like that, especially when are you practicing medicine without a license? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it seems that you can go after more people for things like that, but I think a lot of times people don't even bother.
No. And again, there are ways you can sort of massage the way you present information or how you present yourself. It was just the other day I was reminded that, you know, to call yourself a dietitian, you know, if you see someone presenting themselves and advertising themselves as a dietitian, that's a regulated business. That's a regulated title. But nutritionist, anyone can call themselves a nutritionist.
You know? It's like wellness centers.
Exactly.
It's not a doctor's office. It's a wellness center.
Mm-hmm.
One of the areas in the pseudo law that I never really heard about until I read it, because it just for some reason it struck me, is that you had a whole section about the flag fringe.
I have to wonder if that's something anyone outside of the practice of law has ever heard about.
Exactly. Is that a big deal in the courtroom?
It's not a big deal. The places I think that you probably run into it the most is if you're a magistrate court judge or someone practicing down in a local traffic court or in a lower court.
Now, before you get too far, what is the flag?
Explain what it is. Yeah. You're exactly right. I talk about flag fringe in the chapter on pseudo law. There is a claim usually among sovereign citizen types that a U.S. flag that has gold fringe around it is, for lack of a better word, legally magical. And that if a flag with gold fringe around it is in a courtroom, then the presence of that flag puts that courtroom under maritime law instead of under the law of the state. And so, you know, in magistrate courts, you pretty much exclusively in cases when someone's going to be in a court representing themselves pro se and without a lawyer, then, you know, you'll find someone going into the court and saying that this court has no jurisdiction over my person because that flag has gold fringe on it. And as such, this court is under maritime law, has no jurisdiction over my person. I demanded these charges be dismissed post haste. And my favorite reaction, I don't remember which judge this is, but it's in the record from somewhere in the States. One judge was presented with this argument, and his response was, you know, so you say the flag behind me puts this under maritime law. Okay, fine. Let's just pretend we're all on a boat. And then he just proceeded to have the hearing as normal.
and we have a plank, by the way.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, and as I explained, the whole flag fringe thing goes back to a gross misreading of an old army regulation and frankly some other regulations that, as far as I can tell, some of these people have simply made up. But it's pervasive among basically the same sorts of people that will also walk into a courtroom and say, ah, this pleading has my name in all capital letters and that's my corporate personhood. That's not me.
Yeah, because you've talked about that in a chapter as well.
Yep. There's a lot of crossover among that kind of pseudo-law.
Because it all feels like all the same. The whole, I don't have to pay taxes because of these weird little rules I don't understand.
Yeah.
And it's all kind of the same thing.
For lack of a better word, I guess it's kind of an anarchist streak that runs through some of it. It's anti-government.
Yeah, I was going to say. Do you think that same, I mean, the whole pseudo-law chapter, it kind of feels like that's kind of the pseudo-law is like the seed for like the Alex Jones type wackery out there?
It certainly is. I haven't listened to enough Alex Jones to hear him espouse any particular beliefs on pseudo-law, but I'm sure he does. It certainly plays in well with their notions of FEMA death camps and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that whole thing to me is the whole, well, because of this weird law, I misunderstand or want to misunderstand.
Yeah. There's a certain, and like I said earlier, there's a certain sort of magical flavor to a lot of it. The notion, and obviously the practice of law does involve a lot of details and you have to do something a proper way, and if you don't follow the procedure, then there's consequences. But a lot of pseudo-law, like I said, it's sort of they believe the law is magic. If they just say the right word or do the right thing in the right place, then, they can win, regardless of what their argument is. They can get the case thrown out because of the flag, or they can get a case thrown out because of the font that, their name is spelled in.
Or what color the binders are on the desk.
Uh-huh.
Tell us a little bit about the Lost 13th Amendment, because that was kind of fun.
The Lost 13th Amendment was something I learned about in the course of developing the book. I learned about it from a birther, in fact, who incidentally gave a gold fringe flag. Gave a non-gold fringe flag to Clayton County. A picture of it online. There was a picture of him presenting it without any fringe on it, and I have to imagine that's why he gave it. But I sat down with him and interviewed him. Perfectly nice older gentleman, odd. And I had not told him I was an attorney. And I was glad I had not when he started mentioning this 13th Amendment, and I asked him to expand on that. And there's this claim out there that the 13th Amendment as we know it, the one that banned slavery, the one that the Spielberg's movie Lincoln is all about passing. It's an awesome movie, by the way. That is not the original 13th Amendment. That Lincoln, as the claim goes, during the Civil War, somehow scrubbed from history an earlier 13th Amendment to the Constitution. And the claim is that sometime back around 1815, that the Congress and the states had adopted another 13th Amendment, which said that no one could hold political office if they had a title of nobility. There's already something in the Constitution that says, you're not supposed to have knighthoods and stuff like that without exception. But this was proposed basically in, I think, more or less in response to the War of 1812.
Yeah.
It was kind of a rash thing. No one's supposed to have a title of nobility and they can hold office. And it was proposed. That's the kernel of truth here, is this proposal did exist. And I think I might have even reproduced the text of it in the book. It's not terribly long. But it was proposed, and a bunch of states did ratify it. I mean, a bunch considering the number of states there were in the 18-teens. But it never got enough. You have to, I think, get 3/4 of the states to ratify before it to be adopted. And it never reached that threshold. In fact, it eventually got the number of states that would have been required eventually, initially when it was proposed. But by that point, there had been more states added. And thus, it still had not reached 3/4 of the states at that time. And I think one of the presidents at the time, John Quincy Adams, maybe had the Secretary of State check for him if it had passed, and their conclusion was no. But so that was the origins of this original 13th Amendment. It got erroneously printed in a couple of books at the time because people were sloppy. And then some fellow, I think back in the 1980s or so, stumbled across this thing and started promoting the idea that because it had showed up in a couple of books, that this meant that it must have been passed. And that Lincoln, for whatever reason, had managed to erase this from the history books. And that there was still this original 13th Amendment that said that titles of nobility, people with titles, could not serve in office. And just to add to the crazy, what they then say is that among the titles of nobility that prohibit you from holding, you know, federal office is the title of Esquire.
That's every lawyer.
That is every lawyer. So basically, they then start to claim that this, you know, failed amendment from, you know, the 18 teens should be prohibiting all lawyers from holding office.
Do they know who actually founded the country?
I think they prefer to not think about that too.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
Yeah. It would rule out several presidents, to say the least.
Yeah.
Not the least, which are second.
Yes. So, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But this is why I'm glad I did not tell him I was a lawyer in this interview, because I realized midway through he really did not like lawyers. But all of this came as a big surprise to me. And there's a fantastic website that I think I give a URL to in the book of somebody who has done a phenomenal job of debunking this. Because as with any conspiracy theory, there ends up being all sorts of little details. They'll claim that this state, you know, secretly ratified it but didn't record it right. They'll claim that another state changed its mind, you know. And he goes through all those individual little claims. I found it fascinating simply because it was a little lost piece of U.S. history I didn't know about.
I didn't know about it either. It's the reason why I had to bring it up. It's like, I didn't hear about this one. And it's when I did some research, suddenly I found all the people out there who believe it.
Yeah. And I have to think that the only reason it survives at all now is because of the lawyer interpretation. I mean, as a simple titles of nobility, who cares if, you know, we don't have dukes to become congressmen. But the lawyer interpretation, I think, is what drives that. Oh, and I can't remember if I put this in the book or not. Amazingly enough, that a reference to this original, you know, air quotes, original 13th Amendment showed up, I believe, in the platform of the Iowa Republican Party a couple of years ago, where it you know, went viral for a little bit because they put a bunch of really fringy stuff in there. And among the fringy stuff they had in there was this reference to the original 13th Amendment. You know, so not even confined necessarily to the fringe, but has found its way to seep into some more mainstream areas, unfortunately.
Well, the funny part is these days it's starting to get a little difficult to see where the fringe and the mainstream might be.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to things like both parties.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of try to, like, you know, stay away from them.
Vote Bull Moose.
But there you go. Let's try to bring that back. Although I think that the name of it probably dissuades some people.
Could be.
It's not as catchy. You can't. It's just not just one word.
No, it's not that.
And nobody wants to have BM in parentheses after their name on the news.
There is that, unfortunately.
I mean, nobody really wants that. So you do all this cool, you know, skeptical stuff. You also have a lot of stuff about free comic books on your website.
I do, yeah. I'm a big comic book fan.
I can tell.
Going back 20 years exactly, actually. I've been a comic book fan for exactly 20 years. It was November 92 when they had the big Death of Superman.
Oh, God, was it that? Was it then?
It was November 1992.
Wow, okay.
And that's when I got started. It's hard for me to believe it's been that long.
Yeah.
Got into comics at the time, have a decent sized collection, and yeah, got a page on the website, put together a number of years ago. It needs to be updated, frankly. Where I just collected a bunch of the free issues that different companies had put online, sort of as promotional materials, but as a means of people to sample good series, before having to go out and lay down money for something that they don't know what to expect. There's, I think, more than one, just to cite one example, I think there's more than one issue of The Walking Dead that's out there online for free.
Yeah, because I was thinking, well, if people don't decide to buy your book, which I think is kind of cool, they should anyway, but if they don't do that, at least they can get free comic books.
Exactly.
If anything else.
I aim to please.
So where can people find out more about you, your work, all this stuff?
Well, the book's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's even in stores. I found in a Barnes & Noble. Made me happy. So that's out there. The blog, the birther blog, Barakraful, it's spelled like first name, barakraypahal.blogspot.com. Had a big expo, multi-part expose a couple months ago about a video that someone was trying to use as smear material right before the election. That I have up on the blog. My research, in fact, got indirectly cited on the president's own website.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, I was quite happy about that. Birthofanotion.com, for the most part, simply represents information from the blog in sort of a cleaner format.
Very cool. And that is, the book is Bull Spotting, and there will be a link in the show notes for people can and buy it.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks once again to all of our listeners, and to the fine folks who contribute segments for the show. And remember to check out all the links to the things you heard here in the show notes for this episode on our website, which is at www.skepticality.com.
Like Skepticality? You can help out the show by writing a good review for the show on iTunes or by going to our website, clearing your browser cookies, and clicking on the Amazon link at the top of our homepage. Every little bit helps keep the show coming to you free on a regular basis.
Snorty.